This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Nobody who's ever read Moby Dick is going to walk away thinking Captain Ahab was a well-adjusted specimen. And Ahab may have fewer issues than some of Melville's other characters. Now, English lit students are trying to diagnose just what the heck is going on with those classic characters.
What happens if Ahab just chills out one day, right? He starts taking Klonopin, he's fine.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, Diagnosing Literature. Then we'll hear about a number of NIH grants to study autism. Find out how Sallie Mae can help you get the most bang for your college buck and spend an academic minute getting out the youth vote. I'm Bob Barry, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. When you think back to some of the most enduring characters in literature, some of those people had issues. Was Bartleby the Scrivener depressed? Did Clarissa Dalloway need lithium? Today's English lit students seem to want to medicate away the problems of classic literary characters. Producer Eric Malinsky from Studio 360 explores this phenomenon with help from NYU professor Elaine Tobin and novelist Michael Cunningham.
There's a professor at NYU who's taught the work of Sylvia Plath for years. One day, her students started to react differently to the poet.
And they were like, I mean, she's such a whiner, Sylvia Plath. She's just like whining in every poem. And I'm thinking to myself, my God, you know, when I was in high school, she was my hero.
When I visited Elaine Tobin's class at NYU, the freshmen were discussing two short stories, Bliss by Catherine Mansfield and Bartleby the Scrivener by Herman Melville.
I would prefer to be left alone here, said Bartleby, as if offended at being mobbed in his privacy.
The students were tossing around the usual liberal arts interpretations.
I know the feminist lens, the Marxist lens, right?
But something new was added to the mix. They were diagnosing the characters.
I'm thinking maybe schizophrenic or...
Okay. And manifesting almost a mania.
I don't know if it's a problem more than a coping mechanism.
He's depressed.
Like, he just seems like someone who's very disturbed.
Something psychological or something that happened to him when he was younger.
I felt some sympathy for Bartleby. Like, what is wrong with him? Why can't anyone help him?
My students do not like misery. They would like to fix the characters.
Tobin hates the idea of fixing a classic character, like Captain Ahab from Moby Dick.
What happens if Ahab just chills out one day, right? He starts taking Klonopin, he's fine, just gets over the thing with the sea, and he just says, like, that whale and I have no problem with him. Just let him go off and enjoy his whale life and meet a nice female whale. And, you know, like, you know, it's the unhealthiness of Ahab's obsession that makes it great literature.
But this is the first generation to grow up in a world where taking psychological medication is considered normal, even for kids.
It really is like these are the vitamins I take every day.
And there's been a cultural shift as well. Tobin calls it the Oprah effect.
So I guess for me, the Oprah effect is this sort of opening of dialogue in America about personal issues and personal crises, but with a really psychological bent and a self-healing bent.
She sees it when her students write personal essays.
And my favorite example of this is I had a student who was related to John Wilkes Booth, who wrote about her great-great-great uncle and what it was like to be in an infamous family. And the final line of the piece was, many think of John Wilkes Booth as the man who assassinated Abraham Lincoln, but I think of him as a failed actor who made some bad decisions. I just wrote no.
You got to accentuate positive, eliminate the negative, and latch on to the affirmative. Don't mess with Mr. In Between.
But when literature is designed to stir empathy, sometimes you want to reach through time and help these poor guys.
I challenge anyone to read The Sorrows of Young Werther and not think, you know, my goodness, somebody should take care of that, if only he had Prozac.
Peter Kramer is a psychiatrist. He wrote Listening to Prozac, the book that made antidepressants a household name. He says stories that romanticize melancholy and depression should be demoted to examples of a bygone era.
You know, on the one hand, you have some set of beliefs that come from an era where we didn't understand mental illness as well and had, in any case, less means of altering it. And on the other hand, I think you have, you know, probably a sadder but wiser perspective, one that is less rich imaginatively, but I think probably offers more hope in a practical sense.
This discussion is not just happening in classrooms. When the novelist Michael Cunningham does readings, people will come up to him and say things like,
I didn't want to read your book because I was afraid it would be depressing.
He has to bite his tongue.
So your purchase on happiness feels so precarious that you think this slender tome is going to actually topple you over into something so deep and dark you might not come back? What about a certain sorrow as part of the richness of human life, as part of the ride?
Cunningham is best known for writing The Hours, a novel about Virginia Woolf. He tried to craft his Virginia Woolf in her own time, but the modern world just kept creeping into his mind.
And one of the great questions among those of us who care about Virginia Woolf and think about her work and her life is Virginia on lithium. Would it have changed the work? Would we have Mrs. Dalloway and To the Lighthouse and The Waves if Virginia Woolf had been properly medicated?
Could she have written about her character's emotions so convincingly?
When Clarissa Dalloway, exulting in her morning's errands, says, life, London, this moment of June. For somebody like Woolf to write about that kind of pleasure in the pure physical world is something. If Virginia Woolf can write about happiness in her characters, we trust her because we know she knew just how bad it could get.
Professor Tobin agrees. The job of art is not to correct humanity, but to show us humanity in all of its extremes.
Of course, it's really fun to look at literary characters and think, okay, what contemporary disorder are they most likely suffering from? If we give them a label, I think it's easier. It simplifies them as characters, which is the opposite of what I think is wonderful about literature, right? That literature often is about being complex.
But a 21st century Virginia Woolf would live in an era where Prozac is an option. A modern-day Lady Macbeth would know the term obsessive-compulsive disorder. Whether they would use those tools to alter their minds and their fates, well, that's up to the next generation of writers. Those books I want to read. I'm Eric Molinsky.
According to the Centers for Disease Control, 1 in 88 children in the U.S. are born with autism spectrum disorder. To study this growing problem, the National Institutes of Health will be awarding $100 million in grants over the next 5 years for intensive study into the causes and treatments of autism. Joe Balinfi from the NIH has a report.
The National Institutes of Health has announced grant awards of $100 million over 5 years for the Autism Centers of Excellence research program. The program will feature projects investigating sex differences in autism spectrum disorders, or ASD, and investigating ASD and limited speech.
The Autism Centers of Excellence, or ACE, research program is a trans-NIH collaboration involving 5 institutes.
Dr. Alice Cao is a program director for autism research at the NIH.
And the autism program has 2 components to it. One is autism centers and the other is autism network.
She explains that the differences between centers and networks are based on the design and the way they are funded.
ACE centers involves multidisciplinary coordinated programs or research that demonstrate cohesion and synergy across research sub-projects and that are conducted at one institution. ACE Network, on the other hand, are multi-site projects focusing on a specific topic of research commonly used for recruitment purpose.
9 grants being awarded for 2012 will support research at individual centers or at research networks, which involve multiple institutions dedicated to the study of ASD. Dr. Cao says the ACE program allows NIH institutes to leverage their resources to support the large collaborated efforts needed to advance broad research goals.
I can give you one example. One of the new ACE network involving four data collection sites and plans to recruit a large sample of individuals with ASD, matched normal controls and unaffected siblings, and to examine six specific differences in ASD, and they will collect enormous amount of behavioral, genetic, and neurological data. And in a total sample will be 625 individuals from age 7 to 17. So such a large project, it's usually unlikely to take place and fund it without such an initiative from NIH.
She adds that having four data collection sites also helps research move more quickly.
If you have only one site of research conducting and recruiting subjects, it would take like 10 years or maybe even 15 years to recruit enough subjects. But by having four sites, we can actually conduct research in 5 years.
She emphasizes that studying ASD is an important area of research.
According to CDC's most recent prevalence study, about one in 88 children in the United States has autism. And ASD are almost five times more common among boys, one in 54, than among girls, one in 252.
For more information on autism spectrum disorders research and funding, visit nichd.nih.gov. And to hear more of the interview with Dr. Alice Cao, listen to episode 170 of the NIH Research Radio podcast. For NIH Radio, this is Joe Belinfi.
Still to come, it's time for recent college graduates to start paying off those loans. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1158. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. It's almost impossible to have a conversation about college without money being a large part of the discussion. For recent graduates, that topic is becoming very real right now. Here to talk about all aspects of financing a college education is Martha Holler, Senior Vice President of Sallie Mae. And Martha, before we begin, Sallie Mae sounds like a government agency, but that's not the case, correct?
That's correct. We're a fully publicly traded company, and we're all about helping families save, plan, and pay for college.
Well, November is an important month for college grads, recent college grads. Tell us why that is.
That's right. Those who came out of school last May are coming to the end of their six-month grace period. That's a transition period that allows them to prepare for student loan repayment. So about this time of year, they'll be hearing from their lenders, and they will be selecting a repayment plan for those student loans. And that can feel like a daunting proposition, but take a big breath. This is achievable. You can do it.
How flexible are those payment plans?
Well, there are a number of different ways to pay back your student loan, and really what you want to do is look at your own financial situation and pick the payment plan that works best with your budget. There's a lot of flexibility built into student loans. For example, you can pay as a percentage of your income. You can pay over an extended period if you want to pay longer, but pay smaller amounts monthly. You can also pay on what's called a graduated basis, which means you'll pay less in the early years, and your payment amount will step up, and you'll pay more in the later years. Really, it's all tailored to what works best for you. But there are a couple of tips that Sallie Mae and America Saves have to help you get started. And one of those is to make your payments automatically. And what I mean by that is your lender will offer you an interest rate discount if you make your payments or if you authorize them to draw your payment from your bank account. So you can save money right off the bat and have peace of mind that your payment is arriving on time.
And of course, that's a lot cheaper for the lender to actually, you know, not have to keep sending reminders and stuff.
That's right. And it's green, so it's environmentally friendly. And it also helps you build that track record of on-time payment, which is building your credit record. So every on-time payment that you make is building a credit history, and that's going to help you the next time you borrow, whether it's to go back to school or get a car or take, you know, buy a house or whatever.
Well, let's look at the other end of college, the planning side, as people get ready to make their college choices right now. It's a little late for people who are going into college in the fall to start, you know, pre-planning, but there are options for people to look at, like scholarships. Where does one look for a scholarship?
That's right. Well, November's a great time to look for scholarships. In fact, it's National Scholarship Month, so that's a good reminder to say, hey, let me spend a little extra time online and see what scholarships I might qualify for. Now, remember that scholarships are free money. That means they don't have to be repaid. So every dollar that you get in a scholarship, that you're awarded in a scholarship, is one that you won't have to pull out of pocket to cover your cost of college. There's a lot of information online. Sallie Mae has the largest scholarship database with information about more than 2 million scholarships. And sometimes when I talk to families, I hear them say, oh, I'm not going to apply for any scholarships because I'm not going to qualify. Maybe they feel like, oh, I'm not the top of my class or I'm not the athletic superstar. But the fact is there are scholarships for all kinds of things, even something as crazy as duck calling or skateboarding. You can write a 300-word essay on how skateboarding has had a positive influence in your life, and it is a $5,000 scholarship to the winner.
There are, now, you said you have a clearinghouse on your website for those scholarships. Are there any other places to look for them?
Yes, there are a number of online scholarship searches. So if you just Google scholarship search, a couple of them will come up. And as I mentioned, Sallie Mae has the largest one. Just one thing we caution families is never pay for scholarship information. So remember, this is free money for college. And we also feel strongly that applying for free money for college should also be free. So if you ever receive something that says, you know, guaranteed to win or only so much, you know, money-wise to apply, we ask you and encourage you to exercise caution when considering those opportunities.
Now, when it comes to financial aid, what should be the first step a student does when they say, okay, well, I'm going to have to go for loans or at least look for some kind of aid for this?
So Sallie Mae advises a 1-2-3 approach to paying for college. So if you are planning to have a child in school next fall, the first step you want to take is to complete the FAFSA. That's the federal government's free application for federal student aid. It is the starting point for any aid that is awarded by the federal government, by the states, and by the colleges and universities themselves. You can get to it on FAFSA.gov. That's FAFSA.gov. With our 1-2-3 approach, we recommend that you get free money first. So you want to complete that FAFSA form. That will help you see what you qualify for in terms of grants, scholarships. You also want to tap into your own savings or even your monthly budget, what you can do out of current income before you consider borrowing. Step two, explore federal loans, which may have the very lowest interest rates. And three, to the extent you still have a gap between what you've accumulated in financial aid and what it's going to cost you to attend, consider a responsible private loan.
We all know that it's never too soon to start pre-planning and to pay for college. What are some of the, I mean, are the 529 plans the gold standard?
529 plans are an excellent option. And Sallie Mae does some research on how America saves for college. And what we find is that families typically use two or three savings vehicles when they're figuring out how they're going to pay for college and where they're going to be saving their money. One item that we offer that's available to everybody and is free is our You Promise reward service. So You Promise allows you to earn cash back for college on your everyday purchases. So we're not recommending that you do anything different from what you ordinarily would. We're not encouraging you to shop other than what you typically do, your groceries, your gas, your online purchases, and so forth. And you can earn 5% back on every purchase, and then you can save that for college. More information about You Promise is available at the letter U, the word promise.com.
Well, we hear so much about, when we talk about college, so much of it now is about financing it. And we hear so many graduates are now, you know, looking for jobs and not having much luck. Is it still a worthwhile investment?
Absolutely. And it's true that there are some who are experiencing difficulty. I mean, let's face it, it's tough out there. But don't lose sight of the big picture. College graduates continue to earn much more than those who only have a high school diploma. And also, when you know, we hear so much about unemployment, the unemployment rate for those with a college degree is half that of the national population. So this is still an investment that makes really good sense. And we hear that from parents as well. Overwhelmingly, they feel like college is a worthy investment, and it's one that they're willing to stretch financially in order to make. And what Sallie Mae cautions is just as great that you're willing to stretch financially, but make sure you have a plan. Nobody wants to overpay for a major investment. Make sure you have a plan, not just for how you're going to pay on an annual basis, but how you're going to pay for the full cost of your child's education. And the other thing that we advise is make sure, once you've made the commitment to attend college, make sure you graduate. Those who don't complete their education default on student loans 4 times more than those who do graduate. So keep your eye on the prize, focus on graduation, make sure you complete. That's how you're going to realize the return on your investment.
Martha Holler is Senior Vice President of Sallie Mae. You can learn more at collegeanswer.com. Young people are becoming a much stronger voice on Election Day. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. It seems that every generation of adults decries the shortcomings of the younger generation. But as Margaret Groark, associate professor of government at Manhattan College, reveals, when it comes to civic participation, the young people of today are outperforming their detractors.
Historically, young people are less likely to vote than their elders. But during the past 3 elections, voters between the ages of 18 and 24 have increased their participation. Early data for 2012 shows the turnout of young voters held steady, while turnout overall fell, thereby increasing the youth share of the electorate. Youth turnout is rising faster than that of the population as a whole. Overall, turnout has risen 5 points since 1996, according to the U.S. Census. But turnout among citizens aged 18 to 24 has jumped from 36 to 49% during the same elections, 13 points. Census data is not yet available for the 2012 election, but the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement estimates that youth turnout was at least 49%, roughly the same as 2008. Factors such as the ease of participation, mobilization, and competitiveness have greater impact on young voters who are still developing their voting habits. Thus, laws which have made it easier to vote, like the National Voter Registration Act, and the spread of early voting, have improved turnout overall and youth turnout in particular. Mobilization also matters, and both parties have done more to mobilize voters in the past few elections because these elections have been so competitive. In 2000, 2004, and 2012, the presidency was decided by less than 3% of the popular vote. A competitive election gives parties an incentive to mobilize and gives voters, particularly those not yet habitual voters, a reason to participate.
That was Margaret Groark of Manhattan College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.